Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country. The kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Welcome to Curious with Josh Peck. Start the show.
Welcome back to the Curious Podcast. My name is Josh Peck, and I'm your host, and your name is Listener. And that's what you do. You listen. On today's show, I'm just kidding, right? What? Am I going to fucking introduce the guest in the middle of a global pandemic? What, am I just going to gloss all over that? Fucking, this is wild. Crazy times, my friends. Crazy fucking times. I've never seen anything remotely like this. And maybe it's because I'm a little more awake. I'm 33 and, you know, I've got a kid and whatnot. So it's never felt more so like I had more skin in the game than right here and right now. And I'll tell you what, it's weird, different, weird when things affect something globally. You know what I mean? Like, inevitably, even if America goes through some like huge, huge issue, you know, you can sort of hinge the economy and people's welfare on the backs of like that everything else around the country is sort of status quo, you hope. And thus, like, well, if there's normalcy surrounding us, inevitably we'll, you know, return back to sort of a normal pace once things are remedied. And yet in this, it's like, hey, maybe we'll look to Canada for, oh God, they shut, Canada shut down. Hey, maybe Italy wants it. Nope, shut down. Well, then, I don't really want to bother China, but China too. China is where it started. Oh, Mexico, it's there now too. What about, who's another ally? The UK. Nah, UK doesn't want nothing to do with us. Oh, all right, cool. So the whole world shut down. The whole fucking world is shut down. It's wild, actually, to talk to people who are older than me, who have definitely seen some shit. Who are like, oh, this is the most extreme thing to ever go on in my sort of my existence here on Earth. So it's wild. And it's speaking personally for me, and this might be an understatement, but I don't like it. This just gets in the way of all my plans. And God, do I have plans? Not to mention, like, it's just, it's an eerie, unsettling feeling. And I don't like to disrupt a routine, and I don't think anyone else does, but the reality is people are sick and dying. And while there's a good chance we're going to survive this thing, we gotta have precautions. Gotta do the right thing right now. Even though I have, ants in my pants, and all I want to do is friggin' go work out, sit in a steam room, and cough on someone. That's what I want to do. I want to go from a gym to a steam room to a dance party with 500 people in a place that the fire general says there can only be 350, the fire marshal. Like, I want to be packed in tight, like sardines. Yeah. I wonder if we'll ever be able to return back to normalcy in the respect of, like, I mean, God knows if you've had any kind of young social life, like most of us, we've been in some pretty tight quarters while, getting our freak on a Friday night, you know, trying to go to the bar, trying to go to the crib, right? That's like the whole thing. I mean, if you go to a club where there's like 5 feet in between you and the next person, you're like, this is a shitty club. There's no one here. They're struggling. They better sell more Ace of Spades and Cristal. you want it tight, right? But now, after this, you like, I fucking, not that I go to clubs anyway, I'm a grown-ass man. It'd be ridiculous for me to be, that's like my biggest fear. Above my wife leaving me, because it would, you know, it would just, it would really, you want to talk about fucking up routine. But, you know, I love her very much and I don't want her to ever leave me. But above the you know, the emotional and psychic damage and trauma that that would occur on me and my family, what seems second to that is the idea of me having to be a single person in my mid-30s trying to socialize. Are you fucking kidding me? And granted, yeah, like I have like a little very minor like traces of quasi-celebrity that could perhaps boost my numbers in some respect of like dates and procuring some sort of romantic encampments. And yet it almost makes it worse. Like, I just don't, and no shade, you know, no tea, no shade, no lemonade. I'm not trying to, you know, I know we all want to meet someone out here, but the prospect of being like in my mid to late 30s or 40s at the club and trying to like make eye contact with the right person and hope that we can stir up a conversation, I can perhaps buy them a beverage or they buy me a beverage, not trying to assume gender roles. And then perhaps we exchange information and go on enough dates to possibly have some sort of physical entanglement. Like this just seems impossible. No, thank you. I don't want to be on Hinge or Bumble at 40. And if you are, fucking go get it, ma'am or sir. Do it up. Go find that special someone. And wow, that's awesome. Because the whole idea of it intimidates me slightly, but I'm impressed. But yeah, it's pandemic time. Viruses don't give a fuck. Everybody's inside. Social media is bringing out the worst in people. And it's going to be a moment. Listen, some might say, and I don't mean to get political here because this is not a political podcast. Some might feel as though we're lacking a bit of leadership during these times. And what I would say to you is look to your boy, Josh Peck, because I will lead you. So if you're looking for any sort of reassurance, Uncle Josh is here to tell you this. Everything's going to be okay. Listen, Coachella, I know you had tickets. I know you're sad it's rescheduled. It'll come back around. March Madness, listen, I had a big Buick deal for March Madness. I love Buick. They're a fucking beautiful company and I wanted to work for them. That's gone. You know what I mean? We're all suffering. We're all suffering, even your Uncle Josh. But the reality is, so we're going to make it through this. We got to stay inside. The old people need it from us. They fought world wars for us. One's in Vietnam, a couple in Korea, and an assortment of other bullshit. In addition to the fact that old people are fucking cute and deserve our respect, and they are at risk. So we got to contain. We got to chill. I'm basically saying this to myself, by the way, because I, you know, listen, I get it. We got to relax. It's all going to be fine. Give it a couple weeks, a month, two max. And then we're going to slowly ease back in. And if not, it's been a great run. No, I don't know. I mean, I look around sometimes of all of us in our human suits walking this like ridiculous existence that we don't know if it was like created completely randomly or if there's some like higher power at the helm of this thing. And it's like, while I really want to continue this odd experiment we call Earth and being a human, there is a part of me that goes like, if this was it, all right, I think... I'd love to do some more yoga and, you know, see my kid graduate high school or college. Let's be honest, high school. Sorry, Max. But inevitably, it's like, I don't know. It's all weird and odd. And I hope everyone's got enough toilet. Why do people hoard toilet paper? That's what I want to know. Like, if anything, you should be hoarding wipes, because this is just a huge, if this virus has taught us nothing, At the least, it has taught us about people's disgusting hygiene. I mean, you think you're clean back there taking that dry ass paper and trying to mop up your disgusting waste from your derriere? Are you fucking out of your mind? There is no way you're clean back there. It's an impossibility. We all need to be using wipes and we need to be doing it now. And the fact that the VP, Mike Pence, is not talking about this, I think is a complete oversight. I want wipes in every single bathroom, pharmacy, takeout, delivery, hospital, bank, and anything else that's open. I think there should be mandatory wipes. Don't have to be brand name. Okay, the reality is I'm dedicated to, I like my, my man wipes, dude wipes. I like those. And I think Charmin makes an excellent one. But listen, regardless. By the way, if you say irregardless, you're not the smartest man or girl. You're not smart because that's not a word. So feel bad about yourself. And check it. Go look it up so you can you can make sure that you're not smart. On today's show, we're going to get through this, everyone. Uncle Josh is here to tell you. We're going to get through this. Just sit tight, okay? Stock market's going to come back. Everything's going to come back in due time. 2020 might be a wash. We might have to we might have to be like, all right, we learned a lot. Because the reality is, my friend Ryan Holiday, who I've had on the show twice, always talks about stoicism. And I like to romanticize that at my core level, I'd be okay going back to being like the poor kid that I was growing up. I wasn't poor, but I wasn't wealthy by any means. And we definitely couldn't make the rent many times. But anyone who's sort of spiritually evolved or seeking in some respect wants to believe that if we lost sort of the pleasures of the flesh, the money, the power, the prestige, the delicious foods and the comfort and luxury of our everyday items, that we'd still be okay. But we're kind of getting put to the test. Not really. Most of us are camped out in our beautiful homes with streaming, internet service and Netflix and Hulu and the rest of it. But what I'm saying is in the face of adversity, in the face of everything within a normal setting, being uprooted and messed around and the prospect of perhaps being inconvenienced for a long period of time, can you get through it? Right? And this, I'm asking myself this because the first couple of days, I'll be honest, I'll tell myself, I was like disillusioned, disbelief, wanted to just stick my head in the sand and say, you're all crazy. And then as soon as it dropped and the stock market fell and the fucking sky started falling, I was like, oh shit. And then I was just overcome with fear and worry and projection because that's the way my brain works. I don't think I'm alone in that. But now that we've had a couple of days to set in, I realize that thank God, assuming this doesn't go for years, I, like many people, will probably be able to withstand the storm, that it would behoove me to help people who are less equipped to get through a difficult time like this and to reach out a hand because this affects people very deeply and strongly, not only their health, but their well-being, their security. And there are so many people that are less lucky and fortunate than I am. And it would behoove me to pay it forward and make sure they're okay too. And use this as a time to make sure that if the sky ever does fall and my Instagram account gets deleted for some reason out of my control, then I'm going to be okay. So I'm using this as a great learning lesson. And I hope you do too. On today's show, Tucker Max. Tucker Max is he became famous for a book he wrote called I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. He, as we talk about, kind of became this interesting counterculture hero. His book was massive and on the New York Times bestseller list. And he was, he became sort of like this bro hero for a while, but has transitioned into this really wise sort of self exploratory dude who's done an incredible amount of work on himself and now has started a huge company that helps other people write books. Specifically, we talk about it most recently, David Goggins' book, which was friggin' massive. And I don't know anyone who wouldn't want to read a book about David Goggins. But Tucker is just, he's a really talented writer, speaker, and I think his entire journey from how his first book was written to inevitably where he is now is super interesting. So I was stoked for him to be on the podcast. And then we talk about plant medicine for like the last 20 minutes. So yeah, get into that. Enjoy Tucker Max.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Dude, I was so confused when I got here. You get like there's rings on every door and everything's locked. I'm like, oh, of course we're in LA.
It's weird up here.
Well, Austin is like no one. You don't have the problem. You don't have to lock everything and have rings on everything. You know what I'm saying? Even offices. Like I was like, what is going on? What? Like, oh, of course.
I listened to you on James Altucher's show.
Yeah.
And you said that moving to Austin was one of the top three most important things you've ever done.
Yes.
Why?
One was getting out of LA. Like it was toxic for me. I hated it here.
How come?
The people.
Yeah.
In the entertainment business specifically.
Fair.
Cause you know how it is, man. Like if you're not a sociopath or totally empty narcissist, it's really hard to be in the entertainment business. Like if you have actual emotions and a soul.
Sure.
Cause those are the dominant like paradigms of people. And like, it's just like, fuck man, it's so draining. Right. And then also just Austin is the opposite. It's so full of so many cool people. It's like there might be more awesome people in LA like as a raw number, but the ratio in Austin is way better. It's like 10 awesome people to every asshole. And here it's like reversed.
Right.
At least, if not 20 to 1.
Here. Is Austin, and I love Austin, is Austin like a weird suburb of Silver Lake meets Tribeca that's just implanted in Texas
or does it have
Texas
it's
in its bones?
It definitely has Texas, right? So yeah. Even though I've been there 10 years and I have seen so many Californians move, right?
I hear that.
And what's funny is 20% of them go back. And it's the ones who are like the super narcissist, shallow people who are like into the club. They're into all the accoutrement of LA because none of that's in Austin, right? Mm. And so they can't find their group of people. And because like if you think about it, Austin is actually a terrible place geographically.
Like how so?
Well, because it's scrubland. Dude, Texas is an awful, awful state geographically,
but
man.
Isn't Austin like the green part of Texas?
Man, that's like saying it's a clean part of a toilet, dude. So like seriously, like this guy, General Philip Sheridan, who's the guy who kind of chased Pancho Villa all around America, he said if he owned hell in Texas, he would live in hell and run out Texas.
Solid.
Like, that's how awful it is physically.
That should be in the license plate.
I know, right? No, but the cool thing about it is, though, is that it selects out of people who aren't there for the right reasons, right? Because you're not on a coastline, there's no mountains. Like, it's green compared to, like, the desert, but it's not like East Tennessee where it's like amazing forests and whatever. There's no physical reason. It's Africa hot in the summers. Dude, it's a terrible place to be. And so if you're there because you want to be around a specific type of person who congregates there, who's willing to give up the amazing geographical stuff. Like the weather in LA is amazing, right? No matter what you say about LA, you cannot argue with 70 degrees and sunshine every single day.
Best in the world.
Right. No doubt.
Yes.
And like the cool breeze. I walk around, I was like, oh man, I forgot how great the weather is, right? But the problem with that is it attracts a ton of crazy people who will stay only for weather, which is like the price you have to pay to be in LA. You don't have to pay that price in Austin. No one there is there for the weather or the geography because it's awful, right?
It's funny you say that recently, and I think it's because it's my kid's pediatrician, my friend Liz Allen, who worked in the Obama administration, who was on the pod recently, and my friend Michelle, and they're all from Buffalo.
Right.
And they're three of the greatest women I know. And I think it's because it's such a depraved, like, tundra
cold,
of a place to
dark.
Grow up.
Why would you live in Buffalo? Right.
Only if you're, like, the best people ever that, like, are only about family mm-hmm. and, like, having a nice, well-respectable life.
Yep, exactly.
It's so funny. I was recently in Dallas, which is very different than Austin. And what I noticed was it was just a lot of buffets and urgent cares.
Dude, Dallas.
That's true. They're like, eat yourself into a fucking coma and then we'll get you out of the coma at the urgent care.
Dude, Dallas is a terrible place. So. Yeah, I know. It's just right. Seriously, it's mini malls. And like, I don't understand why anyone would live in Dallas.
Yeah. Is there a border when you're in Austin where you feel like once you get outside the city lines, you're like, oh, I'm in Texas now.
Yeah, people ask, where you live? I'm like, Austin. Like, oh, Texas. Like, no, not Texas. Texas is a different place. I live in Austin. It's kind of circling back to the other question. It's a perfect mix between like the red and the blue states, right? The good parts of the red state is like genuine people. Everyone's nice. Things are cheap. Things like that. And then, but you get all the good stuff in blue states, which is like people are smart, people are ambitious, people want to do stuff, people, believe in progress, right? So you kind of get a really, really good mix and the two sides kind of balance each other. But you go an hour in any direction and you're in Texas.
Right.
You're in like, you know, Texas,
proper,
Texas.
Proper.
Yeah.
And do you think that's what attracts people like you or our mutual friend Ryan Holiday to a place like that or Aubrey Marcus?
Yeah, I know. Aubrey lives in my neighborhood, man. Like, yeah. I could almost hit, if I played golf like an awful person, I could almost hit a golf ball to him. I think so, man. I think it really is like, if you really want to be around, if you want to be around awesome people and with that mix, I don't know of a city in America that's a better mix of that, right? I've been everywhere in America. I can't think of anywhere I can live anywhere. Like, I have no geographic reason to be in Austin. Dude, I only thought I was going to be there 6 months. When I left LA, I had a book to write, and I literally drove downtown. This is in 2009. So it's the America was starting to come out of the bottom of the real estate issue. And so I go downtown and I pick like the nicest apartment building. I just walk in. She shows me this gorgeous place. And I'm like, how much is it? And she's like, what was it? Like $900.
No.
She said $900. And I said, man, you know, I'm coming from LA, right?
Right.
And I was like, man, that's a lot weekly. And she goes, weekly? That's monthly. And I was like, I started laughing at her. I was like, oh, sign me up. And she's like, well, but 6 months, it's going to be like $200 more dollars a month. And I'm like, stop it. I don't care. Like, get out of here.
Yeah, we'll be just fine.
It's this beautiful, gorgeous two-bedroom place and like a windows everywhere. I'm like, oh, this place is amazing. And so it's like, and I just stayed, dude. Like, I re-upped my lease. And then I re-upped again, and then I re-upped again. And after 3 years, I'm like, I guess I live here.
Yeah.
Because I met so many cool people. And it's like, I'd been in New York, and New York's great, and LA, you know, is LA. But I'd never been around so many cool people. It's so relaxed and so cheap and so, like, you can just be a human being there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it's funny. I love Austin. I've been there three or four times. And my wife, my sister-in-law, was living in Nashville for about a year or two. And, you know, my wife's family, like, they love country music and they're just like good, lovely white people. Mm-hmm. And Nashville's been on this, I don't know whether it's due to Instagram, but everyone and their fucking sister wants to move there. And I'm like, oh, I don't know if you actually want to live there.
You understand that. My wife's from Nashville.
Okay,
we
so
spend
you
a
get
lot
it.
Of, I totally know Nashville very well.
It's like, it's lovely. Mm-hmm. It's charming. It's a street. Nashville is one street, and then you're like, oh, I'm in Tennessee.
I'll tell you who should live in Nashville. If you have like a Jesus fish on the back of your car, you should totally live. But you want to feel cosmopolitan, Nashville's the city.
Solid.
That's the city. Everyone I know a lot of awesome, smart people in Nashville, but they are the type who like their core identity is Christian, right? Mm. It is like, I'm not talking about people who go to church. And no, I'm talking about like, this is my thing. Like, they want to know what you believe before they do business with you. That type of person, Nashville is the epicenter for them.
Hectic.
Yeah.
So, no, not a lot of hot-blooded Jews like myself in
Nashville. I don't think so, no.
So, tell me if this was misreported. You were born in Kentucky?
No, I was born in Atlanta, but I kind of grew up in Kentucky, yeah.
Got it. Mm. And then when did you make your way to South Florida?
Well, my parents were divorced when I was a year and a half. And so my dad ended up going down to South Florida, and he's been there for basically my whole life. He had opened a bunch of restaurants. You probably have grandparents in South Florida since you're Jewish,
please,
right?
Are you kidding me? God's waiting room.
You know what's funny is, dude, I'm 25% Jew. My dad's half Jew. And my grandfather, obviously, is full Jew. We had no idea until I did 23andMe.
Wow, mazel.
Because seriously, congrats. His parents came over in one of the early persecutions before, like, the big one at World War II, and anglicized their names, moved to L.A. I mean, he grew up here. My dad and my grandfather just said, all right, we're American now, and picked Catholicism for some reason.
Wow.
Never told my dad or granddad they were Jewish.
That's wild.
I know. I'm 25% Ashkenazi Jew. Had no idea.
So the Max is a German Jewish.
Hungarian.
Hungarian.
Yeah. It's some anglicized thing, but yeah.
That sounds right. Listen, I did 23andMe. I came back 98.9% Jew, okay? You think a couple of my cousins fucked in the 1800s? For sure, dude. For sure.
Was it Neanderthal? Did you have any? Because I had like 1.5% of that.
I wasn't sure the percentage. They were like, you are more so than most.
Yeah.
Weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and what's your life growing up, like during your teen years, your adolescence?
So it kind of sucked because I didn't really have, my parents were fairly broken people who just, like, they weren't good parents. They weren't bad people. Like, they didn't beat me or, you know, put anything in my butt or anything, thank God, like that, right? But they just weren't, they weren't emotionally connected to themselves, so they just couldn't be good parents, right? So, like, I had a very lonely, kind of isolated childhood. And I was a weird kid because I was pretty good at sports and I was smart, but I didn't like the jocks because they were all meathead idiots, at least in the schools I was in Kentucky. And I didn't like the smart people because they were all kind of like socially isolated nerds. And so I was like, but I wasn't that outgoing either. So I was like this weird dude that kind of walked in the middle that never really fit anywhere, but I wasn't really, like, I didn't deal with a lot of bullying or any of that kind of stuff. So, like, I just dealt with, like, a pretty lonely childhood that had parents who, like, just weren't there for me very much, you know? And then I had a grandmother who was a yeller, so there was enough stress that it was stressful. But yeah, no, dude, it was not a fun childhood.
What, were your parents just more narcissistic? Yeah. Like,
no, yeah. They were, so they're both boomers, right? And like they could be the dictionary definition of boomer. This is how boomer they are. So you know the movie Blow?
Sure.
Sorry, George Young, who basically brought Coke. Right.
Ted Demme.
So my parents they met in Manhattan Beach. My mom was a flight attendant for Pan Am. My dad was a stockbroker. They met at one of George Young's Coke parties.
Great.
Doesn't get more boomer than that.
Good party.
right.
My wife's from Manhattan Beach. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So they're two boomers having a good time. Mm-hmm. They have a kid, and all of a sudden that kid's getting in the way of their good time.
Basically, they actually did get married because it was still that time. And then my mom got pregnant through birth control. And honestly, they didn't want me. Like, and it wasn't like a... They fulfilled their, quote, social obligation, but it pains me to say this in a lot of ways. It's true. They both probably would have been better off without kids, and neither one of them had another kid. Yeah. Even though they both moms – my mom's been, I think, on her third marriage. My dad's on his fourth and never, ever had another kid.
Romantics. They believe in the institution. When – you know, and we'll get into it because I know you've done an incredible amount of analysis.
I assume we're recording, right? Because we just jumped in. Okay, cool.
Turn on the levels, Kevin. So I know you've done an incredible amount of analysis and therapy, but was there a time in your youth where you had that first moment where the suspicion came over you where you were like, this is going to fuck with me? Like, this is probably, like, was there any awareness?
Yeah. So I think maybe the first time I can think of, what leaps to mind is when I was 12, my mom was always going through problems and having her sort of breakdowns or whatever. And she had convinced me that I was the crazy one and the problem, right? And I'm sure I was like not that good of a kid at 12. I wasn't bad, but I wasn't that good. And so she took me in to see a psychologist, this woman named Pat Wellens, who I think is still practicing in Lexington. She's a saint. And she like did a couple sessions, one with my mom, one with me, one with us combined. And then she did a private session with me and she said, Tucker, I'm going to tell you the truth. You're not crazy at all. Your mom has a lot of issues. She's not working through any of them. So what I'm going to do is take you on as a patient and we'll help you. I'll help you work through your stuff as much as possible because you do have things you're going to need to work through. But like basically I'm helping you because paraphrasing, your mom's not doing the job.
Yeah, it was kind of parenting in an interesting way.
Right. And yeah. So like she was I had just enough intersections with caring, loving people in my life where I didn't become like one of the sociopaths in LA, like running a management or entertainment company, thank God. Mm. And so she was one of them. Yeah.
So like I never met my pops and my mom is the best, but you know, she was doing her best as I was growing up and thus it resulted in like a lot of financial insecurity and whatnot. Mm-hmm. The byproduct of that is my defense mechanism was a deep-seated need for control.
Yeah.
Because I was so powerless as a kid.
Yep.
So how did that sort of environment reveal itself in bad habits?
Oh, dude. Well, I mean, like, you can go read all my first series of books and know where mine is, right?
Right.
Mine's not about money or that stuff. Mine is very much about women, right? Mm. A lot of it. Not all. But a lot of it's about women. And, like, it's funny. It's like... man, I spent pretty much, I want to say my whole, not childhood. It took, I had to hit puberty and then get a little bit decent with women, which I didn't, it took me to about 17, 18 to figure out what I was doing. And then from about, I dated a couple girls who were awesome women. And like, if I was at all emotionally stable, I would have married. There's one at 18 to 20 I dated and then one at 24 to 25 or 6. I could have married either one of them, amazing women. Both have gone on to marry incredible guys and have great families and they were amazing, right? But I wasn't ready. And so then like about 25 is when I really was like, oh, like instead of feeling my emotions or understanding any of it, it's like I'm gonna go bury all my shit in as much pussy and alcohol as I can.
Solid.
And so it's what I did, man. And it was like everything in my life was how do I get women to like me so I can hook up with them? And then looking back in retrospect, it's really clear that a very common strategy for dudes to use is if they felt abandoned by their mom, I'm going to hook up with a bunch of women and abandon them, right? Mm. And so I was never like, oh, I love you, and I'm marrying them or have kids, nothing that. It was just like hooking up, and then like they'd be into me sometimes. A lot of times they weren't, but sometimes
they were mad at their dads.
Right, yeah, right. Oh, total, 100%. The dynamic with me and most girls at that age was, I'm lonely, me too. I hate my dad, I hate my mom. Let's hook up. Okay, great.
Like, wow.
All understated subtext. None of it was above board. About 29 to 31, I started to kind of figure it out, but it was one of those things where it was like I was having too much fun and it was too awesome in my mind that I was like, I'll pay the price for this later, right?
Right. Well, sex too is one of those like really insidious sort of addictions or coping mechanism things. It's like food and like finance, like, you know, if you're, you know, super greed driven, right? Because we need shelter, we need to reproduce and we need nourishment. It's not drugs and alcohol where you're like, I can push this away forever and not wake up hungover. It's like, even if you wake up with like someone who you shouldn't be waking up with, it's like,
it's fun.
You shake it off.
Right. There's a coolness to it.
People are going to laugh.
Mm-hmm. Same with success. Like, right. I mean, I know tons of entrepreneurs now, and I would say 90%+ of them, success is a way to avoid feeling their feelings that they don't want to feel.
Yeah.
You know, like, which is, that's way better than being a heroin addict, right? Like, it's more productive, but it's, you're still going the same place, running from the same stuff.
So when do you make your initial sort of pilgrimage to South Florida?
So after I was fired from being a lawyer in 3 weeks, And then went to work for my dad because he has a bunch of – he's been pretty successful restaurateur and had a bunch of restaurants. He fired me in 6 months. So I moved down there full time because I visited him not that much. I would see him once a year. Are you old enough to remember the movie The Toy?
With
Jackie Gleason and
Oh, yeah. So Master Bates.
That's right. That's yeah. So I was basically my life with my dad was like The Toy, except he had nowhere near that much money and didn't give me really any money. He had money, but like didn't give me any. And there was no Richard Pryor in my life that was fun. But like it was, I would see him for 1 or maybe 2 weeks a year, usually one, and that was it. And then I moved down there. Right after law school. So I was 25, 26. So it was like, it was right before 9/11. Yeah. So it was 2001. Mm. And then I was there for about a year and it was just awful because South Florida is the armpit of America. And it, like, I didn't do drugs. Right. And so it was like, what do I have to talk about with anybody here? I wasn't old and I didn't do drugs.
Where were you? Boca, Fort Lauderdale?
Yeah, right, Boca.
Boca. Yeah, great. Which is,
well, I mean, the belly of the beast for this, right?
I lived there.
You did?
Growing up, Hammock Point Elementary.
No.
Shout out. Yeah, I went there. My mom and I would pop back and forth between New York and Florida when money would run out.
Yeah.
So, and my grandmother lived in Delray. Yeah. So, yeah, I know it well.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. My dad lived in Royal Palms, had a huge house there until his third divorce. And that wife, Patty, kept that house. But I was there for about a year and a half, 2 years. I hated it. It was the worst.
And do you find, like, I found as a young man, and it, interestingly enough, it was like in the year leading up to meeting my wife, that I felt as though I was at the height of my powers, where like I had sort of come into my own as a man, mm-hmm. where I felt like I'm the best I've ever looked. I'm the most confident I've ever been. And I was putting up great numbers.
How old were you at the time?
I was 24.
Okay, yeah. You met your wife then.
I met my wife at 24. We met at 24 right before I turned 25.
And then you started dating? And then?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You're way more emotionally mature than me, dude.
I got sober at 21, though. I'm a former child actor. I'm a fuck up.
Yeah, right.
So I just did it way too quick.
Yeah, you did it quickly, right. It took me a long time.
So did you, when you were in Florida going through all this, is that how you felt then? Like, I am at the height of my powers?
No, I was the opposite. I was depressed.
Really?
Genuinely, seriously depressed in South Florida. That was the closest I've ever come to, I think, actual depression. I hated every single thing about my life. Yeah, there was nothing I liked. It was terrible.
But you're also sleeping with everyone.
I was hooking up with the girls that I was the least repulsed by, right? Because it's South Florida. So they're either on drugs, and if they're doing coke or whatever, they're not into me because I don't have any coke for them. And so like, or they're idiots because if you like are smart, you don't live in South, at least at the time, you don't live in South Florida. Or they're, you know, Hispanic, but I don't speak Spanish. So like all the awesome hot Cuban girls, like, hey, nah, I don't care, right? Like,
sure.
So I had no, like there was really no one for me to talk. There's random smart girls in Florida, but they like stay in because they hate all the same stuff I do. So this is before Tinder, so we couldn't like
connect,
meet each other. So it was just a hellscape for me, dude. It was the worst, man.
Man. And so then, and is this before you meet Miss Vermont?
Or no, that was in, Miss Vermont was the iconic South Florida girl. I mean, she was this. So, for your listeners who don't know the story, super quick. I was in the.
This is a treat, guys. Buckle up. Get ready, Kevin.
No, it's a sad story at the end. It's funny on the way to a lot of sadness. So I meet her like this place called the Athletic Club, which is like imagine like the scene-steriest Equinox in LA. Like that was the equivalent in Boca, and like I see this because she's pretty hot. Obviously, she's got like a her baseball cap on, whatever. And like she had on Stetson Law shorts. And so I was like, okay, she either is hooking up with a dude who goes to law school there or she's smart. And so I started talking with her about that. Oh, I went to Duke Law, blah, blah, blah. And then like, we went to dinner that night, asked her out. Yeah, of course. She was a pageant girl, had been Miss Vermont twice. Even though she grew up in Florida, she moved to Vermont to be Miss Vermont. Like Miss Vermont, US, there was two different pageant tracks, Miss America and Miss USA. She was Miss Vermont twice. And then like her platform was abstinence and sobriety. And then we got really drunk and hooked up in the back of her Ford Explorer that night. And so then it was like 28 days I did. I think it was 28 or 29. I counted because they were wild and crazy in both good and very bad ways. Like I took her She'd never shot a gun, so I took her to a gun range. This is how smart I was at 25. I took an emotionally unstable girl to a gun range, taught her how to shoot. And then when we, quote, broke up, she put, like, I gave her, like, she took one of the targets home, you know? She, like, drew all this stuff on it and then, like, put it on the windshield of my car after
Solid.
Oh, but it wasn't, like, a threat. It was, like, this weird, vague, like.
A memento.
Right? No, she's like, we had such a great time for 28 days and blah, 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 except then we fought. And, like, it was, like, this weird thing. It was, like, at the time, I, like, laughed at her. Now it's like I look back and I'm like, we were both just sad, broken people who were like trying to find some relief from our awful depression.
Yes.
It didn't work for either of us. But no, it was, that was basically South Florida, dude. I mean, it was, that's in a nutshell. Yeah.
And then when you wrote about her in your book, she sued you.
No, her mom did.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she's the iconic pageant girl. Like the mom lived through the daughter, right? That's why I feel so bad for her, is because, like, now especially, because the poor girl had no shot, man. Like, she had this mom who's, like, basically, like, I don't know, has all this pageant stuff. So, like, everything that the daughter did was because the mom wanted her to, right? So she wasn't living her own life or being her own self. And so, yeah, no, the mom sued. It's funny, man, when I wrote the story, I sent it to her and I said, hey, if you want to write a response or whatever, I'll put it verbatim beneath the story on my own site so everyone will read both sides, right? Mm. I'm like, I won't change a word. You can say anything you want. I don't care. And she never responded, the daughter, right? Because I'm not emailing the mom. And so then like MTV did this thing about me. It kind of blew up my site and that's how I kind of became a writer. And I guess all the mom's friends saw it, sent it to her. And so the mom went to Katie and was like, is this true? And of course Katie lied because that's what she's done her whole life with her mom because it's the only way she can get her mom off her back.
Sure.
And so the mom's like, well, then we're going to sue him. And then like it started this whole rabbit or this whole chain of events. The New York Times, this was front page news at the time because it was the first time, like, first big free speech case for the internet. And so, like, the mom was a lawyer. Her friend was a judge, issued a temporary restraining order against my site. It's called prior restraint in First Amendment law. First time this had ever been done for a website. And like, basically, just the summary of this is, prior restraint is essentially illegal in American law, except unless it's like a national security. Like a newspaper can print anything they want, but then they can get sued about it. By law, you cannot stop them from printing stuff unless it's like printing the names of spies or something. Like the government can come in and say, well, yeah, that's a national security threat. That's it though. So this judge literally made me take stuff down. Not suing for defamation or libel, right? And so the New York Times like interviewed all these big First Amendment lawyers, scholars, and they're like, this decision is kooky. Like it makes no sense, right? And so of course the mom was, the judge was embarrassed. The mom was totally embarrassed, all this sort of stuff. I got these huge lawyers on my side. It was like this whole thing. And then it brought, it's the thing that blew me up even more than the MTV thing was the mom suing me about this, right? I mean, it was like, the best part was I was like, I would love to go to court about this because in America, truth is the absolute defense to libel. And like, I have pictures of all of this, of us together. And like, you know, I had the gun target she shot up and left on my windshield.
Good
right?
thing you saved it.
How was I not going to say that? I'm going to show it to my friends, of course, right?
Right.
As a 25-year-old, this is the coolest thing ever, right?
Right.
And so anyway, so yeah, that started the whole thing. And then I just started writing the books and they blew up. And then, you know, here we are.
And what do you think? Your story started out on email chains.
Mm-hmm. To my friends, yeah.
To your friends, which then became the blog,
mm-hmm.
which was kind of one of the first blogs.
Yeah, it was like one of the very first, right? And the only reason I put myself, I mean, dude, this is in 01, 02. This is back when GeoCities still existed. Like you had to learn HTML to have a site. And the only reason I put it up is because like I went to every publisher and every magazine and tried to get my stories published and literally no one wanted to publish them. Like the few responses I got back were the type of thing where it's like someone was personally offended, which I should have known was a precursor for what was to come. But like someone was like, oh yeah, you should never write an email again. This is the worst thing I've ever read, like that stuff. And so like literally the stories that made up a book that created a new literary genre and has sold millions of copies, they're like, this is the worst stuff I've ever read. And so I had to put up a website. The word blog didn't even exist then. So I just had to put stuff up for free. And then it, like all the strategy everyone uses now, I totally stumbled into by accident.
Right.
And it worked.
Did you, and you knew Ryan Holiday back then, right?
No. Dude, at that point in 2002, Ryan was like 8 years old or something.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
He's older than me.
He started working for me. He was my first assistant. He started working for me in 07 or 08.
But you were
when he was in college,
and you didn't do anything with American Apparel, right?
No. So Ryan worked for me for like a year, 2 years, and then I got him a job at the Collective, which is like a big management firm.
That's where I met him.
Right. So exactly. So he worked for Aaron Ray there for about a year, and then from there he went to working for American Apparel. Yeah.
Got it. So the blog starts to blow up, and you start compiling these stories for the book, and. To your point, and it's so impressive that you sold millions of copies of this book without any sort of like the institutional backing that so many of these books see. What can you attribute that to besides the fact that it was a great book?
The right thing at the right time. Mm. That's it. Like it's, dude, everyone asks me like, how do I write a hit? And I'm like, well, first I've got to write a great book, but it also has to be the right message at the right time. Like I own a publishing company now that helps people write and publish books. We did David Goggins' book, right? Which was the second biggest memoir of the year last year after only Michelle Obama's, which was like the biggest of all time. And like everyone comes to us now, is like, yeah, okay, how much does it cost to be David Goggins? I'm like, nothing. There's no amount of money. If I could do that, I would, you know, do it for myself. Why would I do it for you, right? There's no amount of money. David had the right message at the right time from the right person, right?
Yeah, go be a Navy SEAL, lose 100 pounds, and then fucking run 100 miles a day.
Become the toughest man alive.
Right.
And it become the toughest man alive and a paragon of old school masculinity in a world where there are no masculine figures, right? And where masculinity is subjugated and dismissed. And so he is like, to people looking for it, a paragon. 10 years before, no one would have listened to him or paid attention, right? It's a different thing. Same as me. If I was, you know, 27 now, I mean, I wouldn't be doing the same things. Everything would be different. But if you just, you know, transported me, my stories would, they'd get some traction, but they wouldn't in any way, shape, or form have the impact they did. Because at the time, I stood up and spoke a truth that everyone felt, but no one was saying. Then I said it, and a bunch of other people started speaking similar truths. And now it's not a big deal to be like, oh, I hook up with a bunch of girls, or I'm an idiot, or I get drunk. No one cares anymore. That's not like a, that's not a controversial thing to do anymore. Mm. You know what I'm saying? And so it was 100%. It's hard to, let's say 50% is you work hard and you have a dialed in really good message. The other 50% is right place, right time, right person.
And what do you attribute, because that all sounds right, and yet I think if that book had any other title, even with the same guts, it would be easier to have passed it over. Like that title at Hudson News on your domestic flight to St. Louis, you're like, I got to pick this up.
Yeah, I mean, that title came just organically. Like I did some awful thing and I wrote a funny story about it at the end. I'm like, I hope they serve beer in hell, you know, just because like recognizing that what I was doing was fucked up. And then it just caught, like people like kept saying it back to me. And I'm like, all right, I guess that's the book title. Like,
and how quickly out the gate does it start to succeed right away?
Yeah, well, it did only because, so it hit the bestseller list for 2 weeks in a row, but only because I had a big email list, right? I had put an email capture on my site and I'm like, I didn't even pay attention to it. I just send out an email every time I wrote a new story. And then like when my book came out, I had like 50,000 emails. Like, oh, great. So I put it out. I sold 5,000 copies the first week, like 3,000 the second week or something like that. And so it hit the bestseller list those 2 weeks. And then it fell off. And it got as low as like 900 a week, maybe 6-7 months. And then that was in 06. It hit in January of 06. And then in May of 07, it went back on. And dude, that was all word of mouth. Word of mouth and I still kept all my free stories up on my site, right? I mean, this is basic content marketing that everyone gets now. I honestly just fell ass backwards into it and it worked, right? It's funny. I get so much credit now. People are like, oh, you're such a great marketer. Tell me all your marketing tactics. Looking back, I don't think all the shit that I did or that I did with Ryan, all that stuff, I don't think any of that stuff helped. In fact, I think it hurt. Like the two things that mattered, right voice, right time, and a bunch of stuff up free. That's it. And everything, because dude, I always tell all our authors, we've done 1,500 books in 5 years, and I tell them all, the only way you're going, your book will succeed beyond, you know, the your universe of people is if you're the people who read it tell other people, right? Word of mouth. And so you've got to write a book at the beginning from understanding, why are people going to read this? Why are they going to like it? And why are they going to tell their friends, right? So from my, I didn't understand that when I wrote my book. It was just baked in, you know? It was just, I was standing up and speaking a truth that a lot of people connected with. At the beginning, everyone was like, oh, this is just like me. And then as it got bigger, then a lot of younger people found it. They're like, oh, that's who I want to be, which took me totally by surprise. Like the idea that like young kids would look up to me as a party icon was like laughable to me. Like it was honestly unthinkable to me actually, right? Because I drank a lot and hooked up a lot, but I was no different than any of my friends. Like I wasn't the cool guy among my friends at all. I mean, I'm just talking about normal dudes, right? But then all of a sudden, like all these kids who hadn't done this stuff were like, and they never heard anyone talk about it openly and publicly with their real name. Then I became the god to them. And I kept trying to tell them, guys, you can do all, and girls, because shit, half my fans were women. I was like, you guys can do all of this. There's no magic about this, right? But like, and so many of them like, oh, this isn't even possible. I'm like, wait till you get to college.
Well, you talk about how you were miserable during this time in South Florida, and then you moved to LA and the book comes out. Where are you?
No, hold on. There's a big gap between there.
Right. Like,
so I moved to Chicago. I lived in Chicago for like 5 years after South Florida. Chicago was amazing. It was a perfect city to live in for me at the time.
So yeah, well, Chicago's a big city with Midwest people.
Yeah, a big city, Midwest people, cheap. Everyone's nice. Like, it's funny, it's not really true anymore, but especially when I was coming up, there's the stereotype that only dumb girls sleep around. And that's so wrong. Like, I made a living off of basically hooking up with tall girls, because tall girls, like, no one wants to talk to tall girls. I'm not that tall, but I'm tall enough, right? Mm. And so I wasn't afraid of tall girls, even girls taller than me. Smart girls, right? Because, like, most dudes are intimidated by smart girls. I'm smart. I'm not intimidated by smart girls, right? So like, once smart girls realized I was smart, then it's like, they were like, oh, here's a guy I could actually sleep with and not hate myself around because he's dumb. Sure. They might hate themselves for other reasons, right? But not that. And then the other was just like, I would always like, in a group of girls, I would never go after usually the hot one, because like the hot one gets all the attention and she picks her friends to be less good looking for her for that. So I would always go after like girl 2, 3, or 4, right? If there's 6 of them, girl 2, 3, or 4 are almost as hot, but they don't get the attention. And I talk to them and whatever. Long story short, that's how I made essentially my living with women, was those 3 underexploited territories. Mm. But like, dude, I mean like, Chicago is full of that. It's just smart girls, tall girls, and like girls who aren't the hot girl of their group. And it was amazing, dude. It was just like, it was the best, I don't know. For a young dude who is totally disconnected from his emotions and using women and alcohol to run from them, I couldn't have picked a better place.
Do you know the movie Beautiful Mind?
Yeah, of course.
And that's how Russell Crowe disproves the forefather, Adam Smith.
Yeah.
Or something. And he
comparative
like
advantage. He's talking about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I remember. Yeah.
And it's like, I don't think
John Nash actually said that. I think that was for the movie.
That was Ron Howard. Yeah. God damn it.
Pretty sure. Yeah.
But it's like, if we all go for the hot girl, we're all going to sort of cancel each other out. But exactly. If we go for her friends, then someone will get, we'll all get laid. And we'll, you know, everyone's hooking up.
Yeah.
When the book comes out, where are you in your emotional life? Have you started this sort of journey of growth?
Hell no, dude.
No, you're still in the heart of it. Dude, and how quickly what's the turning point, right? To all of a sudden, you're now not just like this incredible Lothario, you're best-selling author Lothario.
Yeah, so, okay, there's a couple things to unpack. So I wasn't even, the book and the stories and all that, like I started writing those in South Florida when I hated my life. And so all of that was a way to not feel my feelings, right? It was a way to essentially do therapy without doing therapy. So instead of looking in and asking myself, why was I sad, right? Why was I depressed? I was like, I'm just going to get drunk and act like an idiot and laugh. Mm. I mean, because sadness and laughter are actually right next to each other as emotions. Most people don't like realize that, but they're deeply connected. Which is why every comic, I mean, it's the stereotype. Every comic is like depressed, right? Because they're using comedy and humor to as one method to deal with their sadness, right? And so, and I was no different. I mean, I just wrote funny stuff instead of being on stage, but the same stuff. And so, no, dude, I was 100% running from my stuff. Now, like, what was the turning point? It did not, that was, book came out in, first book in 06. I really committed to this in, let's call it 02. Book came out in January of 06. I committed the end of 02, so it's about 3 years, two, 3 years. Then the turning point for me, man, was, well, no, from there, so I might have started getting into therapeutic and self-realization processes, except I became famous for drinking and hooking up.
Yeah, so what's that like?
It's both the greatest and the worst thing ever. So it starts off as the greatest thing ever. The metaphor I always use, or the example I use for people is, imagine that you've spent your life on a desert island and you're just barely eking out an existence, right? You're alive, but you're always hungry. There's never enough to eat and everything's hard. Now imagine you get picked up by a cruise ship and then they have like a cruise ship buffet and they're like, oh yeah, dude, eat all you want.
Right.
You're going to live at the buffet. And you're going to eat until you throw up, and then you're going to eat more. And yes, you're going to do it for at least a while, right? That's what it's like. You know this because you've been famous, right? Dude, when you are not famous as a guy, it doesn't matter how good your game. And my game got really good, but you still have to go out and do things for women. When you're famous, women come to you. It's fucking amazing, dude. It's like this like, it's not even a world you can understand as a guy, because it doesn't matter how good you are in game. It doesn't matter how good looking you are. It doesn't matter how rich, whatever, right? You still have to do things. But then all of a sudden, women come to you, and almost all women understand this, because like, you've got to be a really ugly woman to not have been objectified at some point in your life. Mm. But no one objectifies dudes. Like, it's just not, no one cares about us. Penis is in abundance, right? Mm. And so once you start getting objectified, you actually, at least I did, I loved it at first, because like, especially for me, because I had this flood of women who were like, gonna work out all their emotional problems on my penis, right? And I was down, dude. I was like, let's go. And it was awesome for like about two and a half years. And then you start to realize that no one actually gives a shit about you at all. None of these girls care about you. You are just a thing to them, an object, which is ironic because I was, of course, doing the same thing to them, right?
Right.
So it's not, it's going both ways. But I'm not anywhere near at the time emotionally mature enough to understand that. So then I start getting frustrated with my fame because I'm like, don't you, like, I'm like, don't you people understand I'm a person? And they're like, fuck you. We don't care about you as a person. We care about Tucker Max, what Tucker Max means to us.
But I wonder, do you think there's a difference? Because I think you said this on Aubrey, where you said, if you want confidence, be competent, right? Uh-huh. Like, being competence is attractive, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. So you had proven yourself, like, you weren't Tucker Max from Jersey Shore,
yeah,
like, or The Bachelor. You were a best-selling author, like, was that...
Was it all the same? That wasn't the narrative. I've never gotten credit for my skill as a writer, mm, partially because I never pushed that, right? I didn't care, but also because, like, I went around the system, and so most writers hate me. No, I'm dead serious. Like, this is another thing I didn't believe until I heard it from other people. Like, one of my old PR guys, this great guy, long story short, he was my second PR guy, but my first big real one. And, you know, worked for a huge firm. And he's like, oh, we're going to get, you know, a front page or a cover of Maxim, all this. He's like, obviously, because this is like at my height, like 08, 09. And then he like went in to pitch me. And he's gay. And he came back and he's like, dude, I have never seen straight boys get angrier than when I brought you up at a pitch meeting. And I'm like, what? Why? He's like, it took me a while to figure out. But he's like, I realized they all hate you because they're envious of you, because these are all dorks. Like, most writers are dorks who were picked on in school, and like, writing was their way to have status and skill and ability. And the only thing that got them feeling good about themselves. And they have all accepted the system. Like, these are all the, you know, the editors at Maxim or whatever. They never broke out as real writers. They wanted to be, but they never broke out as writers on their own, you know, like established writers of books and whatever. And here you are, and they see you as the jock that made fun of them, right? The bro. And you are succeeding in their field without following any of the rules they followed. And so, like, you are a complete threat to their identity and they fucking hate you. And I was like, that makes total sense. And I never in a million years would have guessed that.
Right.
Never. And so, like, I never got credit for being a great writer from writers because, they couldn't, right? Because then it forces them to look at themselves, right? Where am I not being courageous? Where, whatever, right? And so that never really happened. But, like, what happened really for me fame-wise is as I started to kind of peak, I started to hate my fame and resent it because, like, I couldn't be a person and I couldn't grow and I couldn't evolve. Like, dude, I'll never forget this, man. I was in a grocery store one time. It was 10 a.m. Oh, no, I don't want to say. I was in a grocery store. It was Whole Foods. And I was shopping, like, you know, whatever, doing a normal thing we all do in Whole Foods. And this dude comes up to me, and he was probably 20. And he's like, oh, you're Tucker Max, blah, blah, blah. I wish I had my book, my friends. And this is before selfie, so he didn't get a selfie. But he's like, dude. And then he kind of looks at me for a second. He goes, dude, why aren't you, like, drunks, you know, under a table yelling curses at people? And I'm like, bro, it's 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. What
right.
the fuck is wrong with you, man?
Yeah.
Like, that was, like, the moment. I use that example all the time because I'll never forget, like, I was like, these motherfuckers will never let me be anyone but who they envision me to be.
But that's not just you. That's
everyone famous.
Everyone right. marries themselves to the image they fall in love
oh,
with.
Oh, yeah. No, I got it.
And I mean, I'm like, I recently over the last few years, I've been, I do a lot of YouTube stuff. And I'm mm-hmm. in this friend group that's, a bit frat-like. And we really bust each other's balls, right? But A, we're all making money.
Uh-huh.
B, we're all funnier than, like, well, because it's what we do. Yeah. Like, we're pros, and, like, everyone's either an actor, a writer, or some version of that. And so I'll be walking around, and a civilian will come up and start breaking my balls. And and it's totally in a fan way, but I want to say—
never funny either.
I want to say, like, who the fuck do you think you're talking to? Like, and they don't know, but they're so confused.
Because they have this deep emotional relationship with you that's completely unilateral.
But we're strangers. Right.
And not in their mind.
Right.
No, in their mind, they've known you for 10 years.
Yes.
Like, they've grown up with you. You're like, you're a thing to them in their life. But that's the point, is a thing.
Mm.
You're not a person.
Right.
No, I went through all that. And then, all right, so the breaking point for me, I still hate talking about this. It's been 10 years and it's still a little raw. The breaking point for me was, I know the exact date. It was September 27th, 2009. I know the date because it was my birthday. It was my Jesus year birthday. And that was also the weekend that my movie came out, the movie about my first book. And it didn't do very well. Like, it was going to be a bomb. And I thought it was going to be a huge hit. And it cracked my grandiosity. Like, it was the hardest. It was the first time in I don't know how long I actually felt some emotions. And I didn't just weep, man. It was like, it wasn't a breakdown, but it was as close as it gets to a breakdown for me, dude. It was bad, man. I was in a hotel. I was in an A-loft in Tempe, Arizona. Like, dude, I remember the whole thing. Like the clear memories everyone has of trauma. This is the same. And it seems so funny to talk about, right? Like, what a rich white person problem.
Right.
A movie was made about my life before I turned 35.
Mm.
And it wasn't a blockbuster. And so that caused me to, like it's hilarious to think about. But it's also 100% true, dude. That was a deeply traumatic event for me. Because, listen, parents are two narcissists. My strategy was pretty narcissistic, obviously. And, like, that broke it, man. It cracked it. And, now, it took, from that point, at least another year before I started therapy. I think it was a year and a half. And then, you know, it was a slow, slow progress to make any progress. But that was the moment, dude. That was the moment that I knew deep down this wasn't going to work. And, like, all the fame, because, like, all the fame, all the money, all the women, way better than being poor and broke and anonymous, but I still wasn't happy. Right, I had nothing. I didn't have anything approaching the emotional inner life I wanted. Because you think when you're poor, broke, anonymous, if I'm rich, famous, rich and famous, everyone will love me, right? You know as well as I do, it doesn't work that way at all. But some people like me have to go through it before you believe it. And then all the feelings that I was trying to chase away with fame and women and money, they were still there. They were just waiting for me, you know?
It's funny because you're right. It is the ultimate sort of champagne problem to have a movie bomb. But there is no feeling, and I've been in some fucking stinkers, because I can assure you that no one who was involved in Cats was saying, I don't think this thing's going to work. They thought it was going to be a hit.
Because it's Cats!
Till the Thursday night before Friday when it opened. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden, the early numbers.
And
they see pre-sales
and like, oh, shit.
And they're like, oh, we're fucked.
Yeah.
And also, it confirms your suspicion, because you were on set and you were like, is this specific? Does everyone want to see a Cats, you know, motion picture? Uh-huh. And it confirms your worst instinct, but you were lost in the crowd and you just felt like, well, if the producers say it's great, it must be great.
For me, I was lost in my own image of my greatness. Not yeah. greatness, my own image of my greatness. And dude, I mean, it cracked. Like, I was lost in my own grandiosity, dude. Straight up.
So what does that journey look like in when you enter therapy? Like how, if you can tell from like, if you can give me a beginning, middle, and end, where did you start to where did you
there's
finish?
I don't think it ends.
Right.
Right? So I'm definitely not, but I tried everything. I tried all the easy therapies, right? Mm. Well, first I got in like amazing shape, washboard abs, blah, blah, blah. Didn't solve my emotions. I fixed everything else in my external life. And then that's why I took a year and a half. Cause I'm like, all right, I'll fix all the, none of that really worked. So then I eventually, it took me about 10 or 20 therapists to find one I connected with. Because I'm like the type, if I go do it, I'm going to do it right. Like, I didn't want to find some, it would have been so easy for me to find like some younger girl who like was enamored with me and I could just play, you know, the game. I didn't want to do that. I found an older woman, smart, who's seen everything, been through everything, like would call me on my shit, right?
Did you think it was important to have, because it's an interesting connection, right? That like what you felt you were lacking from your mom and you found a female therapist.
Of course, obviously. Like clearly.
Interesting. Like, because my shrink's an older dude.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, fuck,
100% makes
dad,
sense.
I need you, dad.
I know. No, seriously.
It's fuck.
That's how great therapy, you are essentially modeling the relationship you didn't have and you work through the issues with them, but mm-hmm. with someone who's a caring, objective mirror, let's call it, right? So anyway, so it took me about 10 or 20. I found one who really fit the bill. And then we started. And dude, I could be the archetype of like the hard client. Because like, you know, I'm the type that I can take, I'll take one side of an argument, I'll beat you. And then I'll take your side and beat you with that side, right? Mm-hmm. Like I can, and so like, but my therapist was so, she was very patient and very like, very, She just like kind of would let me flail and then like come back with just these little questions. And it was like, I'll never forget, like when it was a couple years in, about 3 years in, I was like, you know, I came to her one day, I was like, I'm very frustrated. Like I want a girlfriend. I know I'm kind of in that spot, or I think I'm in that spot, but why am I not like meeting the type of girl I can marry? Why am I dating? And she's like, well, where are you meeting these women? And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, how are you meeting them? And she's, I'm like, oh, and then I like at events or basically her point was every woman I was meeting was through the lens of Tucker Max, right?
Sure.
And she's like, no girl that you're going to meet because you're quote Tucker Max is going to be what you're looking. She's not going to be a whole person. You're representing something to her. You're not an actual connection. And but she never said that. It was all through questions, right? And then it was like, man, she took me through this whole tedious, awful journey. But doing it right therapeutically is essentially question-based. And I got to figure it all myself. And dude, man, I fought therapy every step of the way, dude. Every step. Which is why, like the last 18 months ago, I started psychedelics and plant medicine therapy. Man, that has been amazing for me because like what those medicines effectively do, one of the major things they do is they suppress or crack your ego. And I've got a really strong ego structure. And I don't mean like that as a bragging, right? Like that's my defense is like I had to have a really strong ego structure to get over the loneliness and having no one there as a kid. And that's like what plant medicines have done for me is help me not either quiet or understand that ego is not me. Right?
Yeah.
That voice is not me. It's a part of me, but it's not who I am. I'm the observer.
And that's Eckhart, right? That's That's a lot of Eckhart Tolle.
That's Buddhism.
Yeah.
Right. That's the Buddha.
Oh, he got it from Buddha?
Of course he did.
What the fuck? And what was he paying him?
100% of Eckhart Tolle's stuff is
this
Buddhism.
This German plagiarist.
No, he's a Buddhist. He says, like, there's no...
Yeah, he's...
Right. I mean...
But it's all... All we're doing in modern sort of spirituality is repurposing ancient truths, dude, right? We're repackaging 100%. Ancient truths.
They figured this shit out. The Buddhists figured this out. Jesus figured it out. All these people figured all this stuff out.
I mean, I'm a sober guy, and it, to me, what's incredible is like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is just, you know, repurpose kind of Christianity, really.
It is.
It's like
100%.
Joseph Campbell's Sermon on the Mount, like, but you know what? It appeals to a drunk like me. And so I'm like, great. You know, if a Jew drunk like me can be like, wow, this Christianity tenet kind of works.
It does.
Perfect.
It does. If you buy in, it works.
So what are we talking, like ayahuasca, DMT,
no,
psilobin?
No. So ayahuasca and DMT are the deep end of the pool. Mm. Most people should not start there. So I went 4 years of psychoanalysis. I ended up stopping after it kind of like petered out. Then I worked with an energy healer, like a Reiki shaman type person. And she was like, I was as skeptical as you can be of that. And she did a session with it. She did a free session because she's like, I'm telling you, the universe says we have to work together. And I was like, stop selling me shit. She's like, I'll do a free session and then you can come back if you liked it. And so she did a session and felt okay, but I was like, whatever. Like, it just feels like when I meditate. And then that night, my wife, by that point I was married, my wife goes, what's up with you? And I was like, what? What do you mean? Because I didn't tell her I'd done this, right? I was ashamed about going to see a fucking shaman, energy person. And so she's like, no, it's good. She's like, I don't know what you did today, but whatever you did, keep doing it. And I was like, fuck. I didn't even tell her then, dude. Oh, this is so funny. This is how big of an idiot I am. So I saw her like every 2 weeks or once a month for like the next six months. And I felt so ashamed that I hadn't told my wife. Like, this is not like some woman I'm hooking up with. Like, I haven't done anything wrong. But I felt so ashamed of myself and not telling her. I sat her down. Oh, God, I'm such an idiot. I sat her down one day. I took her by the hand. And I'm like, honey, we have to talk. And I'm like, I looked her in the eye. I said, I'm seeing somebody. And then she could do face drops. I'm like, no, not like that.
Oh, what a fucking terrible setup. You were asking for it.
Dude, I swear to God in my life, that wasn't even going through my head.
Oh, my God.
It was just like, her heart dropped out of her ass. And I'm like, no, I'm seeing an energy worker. And she's like, you're fucking her? I'm like, no. She's rubbing her hands over me. And like, I'm holding crystals.
Dick, Tucker. The energy of your dick.
Dude, and it was so funny. She ended up working with her, but it took her like a month just to get over the association because she just assumed. Anyway, so I worked with her for about a year. That kind of ran out. And then I was kind of doing nothing for about a year. And then a buddy of mine did MDMA therapy, and I saw this insane change in him. Mm. Like, it was incredible. And I was like, I had had friends of mine, like, famous people who I think some of them have been on your podcast. If not, people you know.
Jason Ellis?
No. I can't. He's private about this, so I can't. Otherwise, sure. I would fucking say, right?
Of course.
But two, but one specifically had been telling me for 5 years. Like, dude, this is like, this will help you a lot. And I couldn't even hear him, you know? Because I remember the conversations objectively, but I don't know why. It was like nothing connected with me. I saw the change in my friend, and then I was like, I'm in. And so I went and did MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. I did a session with a woman named, her stage name is Ann Other. She wrote a book called Trust, Surrender, Receive, which is on Amazon. And the first time, I had never done drugs recreationally, never. I had never done ecstasy, nothing, alcohol and women, that's it. And so the first time that shit hit, I was like, what is this? Like, I felt the deepest love. I didn't even know you could feel love like this, man. I didn't know these emotions were possible, man. Like, I had never felt anything like this.
Are you getting it in an IV?
No. MDMA, it took orally. It's just like ecstasy you would take. You know, it's the active ingredient. It's a...
No, right. It's Molly.
But yeah, exactly. It's a pure MDMA.
And do you ever source like where they're getting it from?
So at this point, yeah, like I've gone upstream and I know the chemist and all, like deep in that world though, you know? So like I'm an unusual person, but it's still illegal. Right now it's in phase 3 clinical trials. It's almost certainly going to be approved for prescription medicinal use. There are actually, I know some people opening clinics because it's been given a breakthrough therapy designation. And so, like, I know a dude opening a clinic in Austin in August. And so it's going to be very limited at the beginning. And then, but the numbers are amazing, dude. Like, the data on this stuff is insane. And so this is, I'm telling you, MDMA-assisted psychotherapy is the first one that's going to hit. And this is going to blow the doors off most people, dude. It is absolutely, I mean, it is the thing that opened me up to myself and to feeling my emotions. I just had a level I could not get through talking. And this stuff, man, it was, if you Google Tucker Max MDMA, I wrote a huge, like an obnoxiously long article about my first two sessions and really just describing from my point of view what happened, what I felt like, all the realizations, all this stuff that came up, man, it was nuts. And like, I mean, almost overnight, man, I went from angry was the dominant emotion in my life, but anger is a secondary emotion. Anger was pushing away sadness, depression, shame, fear, whatever, right? The anger was almost gone immediately. And then I was able to start feeling the rest of the stuff, which sucks. Don't get me wrong. But the way to get past it is you got to feel it and let it go, right? And so I'm a year and a half in. Then I did probably 4 or 5 MDMA sessions. Then I moved to psilocybin. And that's coming in the pipeline behind MDMA. It'll be legal in maybe 4 or 5 years. And maybe quicker in Oregon, depending on how some ballot stuff goes. But dude, that was like amazing, man. It essentially rewired my brain. You know, like it's what it does. Like it psilocybin, it resets what's called a default mode network. And so it essentially creates an open, and again, this is a very loose explanation, but it creates a space for you to re-experience and rethink a lot of things and essentially cuts like a lot of old habits and then you can build new ones. Like that's just a very simplistic explanation. But man, those two things in combination just fucking changed the game. And, you know, now I've moved on. I do LSD therapy has been amazing for me. I only do this stuff therapeutically. I don't know how you can take this shit and go to a concert and shit with people. Fuck, man. I take even 3 grams of mushrooms and I'm on my fucking ass.
Three grams is a shitload, Tucker.
Dude, my first session, I did 8.5.
That's a hero's dose, they call it.
5.5 is a hero's dose. 7.5 is superhero's a heroine's dose. 8.5 was but I had such a strong ego structure that like I had to take that much to get past it. Yeah, it was bad.
So when you like take the MDMA, what happens between, about how long does it take to kick in? 30 minutes?
Yeah, 35. 40. Yeah, 30.
And is there therapy going on until then, or is she like, just wait here?
So there's a couple ways to do it, right? But mainly what you do is you take it, you wait, you put on an eye shade, and you lay back on your sofa, right? Or on the therapist's sofa.
Oh, terrifying. Then, waiting for it to kick in.
Ideally, what you should be doing is just like meditating, resting, relaxing, which is really, is like impossible, right? Of course, for me. And then once it hits, man, I'll never forget the first session when it hit. It was like, oh my God, it sneaks up on you. And all of a sudden, you are totally relaxed and in love. It's fucking nuts, man. And then stuff starts coming up, right? So basically what MDMA does is it triggers your brain to dump all its serotonin. So you feel safe and stable and you feel just totally fine. Your brain is like feels as good as it can feel. And so that allows essentially your brain to bring up old trauma. So now it can process it, right? And so a lot of times what happens is shit gets actually real intense. Like, I mean, especially my early sessions were incredibly intense. Like a lot of stuff came up, but you feel capable of handling it, right? And so if you want to talk, then you can talk, absolutely. For me personally, most of my stuff was somatic. So meaning like I was like basically shaking the whole time. Like imagine like a seizure, but slow motion, right? And because the way I guess I dealt with a lot of my trauma was just forcing it inwards, right? And just not feeling it. And so talking for me was a distraction. But I've seen sessions, other people, like I've sat with, I didn't guide friends, but I'll be there with them. And where they are just blah, 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 blah the whole fucking time. It's like a therapy session. But then like they'll come out and be like, dude, that was like 5 years of therapy in 6 hours. Right. You know, because you're so open and you're so accessible, you can dive into and feel and see and understand things that essentially your brain is just not willing to let you experience in a normal state.
Do you have to deal with the dump the next day?
For MDMA, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but there's ways to deal with that, man.
5-HTP and taking supplements.
What I find is SAMe is a better supplement. And so a lot of times, like what the good guys I know is they'll give you a shitload of vitamin C ahead of time because it helps your, I guess, neural connections. And then take that and then they'll give you SAMe, like 4 or 5 days of it. And you're basically fine. The other thing that I've started doing that works really well for me is I'll do MDMA in the morning and then psilocybin in the afternoon of the same day. And it's, I mean, that's a full 12-hour day of dealing with shit. But at least for me, and I've seen for a lot of other people, psilocybin acts as a serotonin antagonist. So it basically stimulates your brain to produce more. Mm. And so as long as you're eating the right stuff, bananas, some other stuff, then like you, like I'll have an incredibly intense day. And the next day I feel like 90% as good as I did the day before. Like I feel almost back to normal because the two things. And then also what's cool is they work so differently. Dude, psilocybin is so fucking weird, man. It is just all symbolic. It's all nonlinear. It's not nothing analytical, logical, verbal at all. And so MDMA is very analytical, logical. Like you can kind of stay in your left brain. Psilocybin's all right brain. So when I do a day of that, I get so much work done and I come out the next day feeling like I can basically go to work if I want to.
Yeah. What, it's interesting. I interviewed Aubrey and we were talking about, and he was talking about ayahuasca. And I said, as a drug addict, I'm in search of a vaccine.
Right.
Like I want to do it and be all better. And I said, my suspicion is that it's but a preview or a like glimpse into something. And then it's completely contingent on what you do to maintain that with this new information.
Yeah, it's called integration. So this is, I've written a lot about this and I have a lot of friends coming to me now. Cause I'm like, I haven't been doing this 20 years. Like I'm not one of the people that's like in this space, but I just stepped in therapeutically. And so like, a lot of people, and I, write about these things, and I'm willing to be honest about it. I know so many well-known people who like do this stuff, but won't talk about it publicly. I'm not judging them, man, but I just feel like that's bullshit. Like this changed my life, and I couldn't get up in the morning and look at myself in the mirror, knowing that this medicine had so drastically helped me. Knowing so many other people are suffering from the same stuff and not talk about it. That I personally can't do that. So I get a lot of people approaching me asking questions. That the big thing I always tell people is, listen, the medicine is great. None of it's a magic pill. None of it will actually do any work for you. None of it, right? It's not like an antibiotic, like that like gets rid of the bacteria. No. All the medicine does is open a space that you can't often open on your own for you to do your emotional work. You still have to do the work. You still have to go in and feel the feelings. Like, dude, I'll give you an example. A friend of mine did MDMA therapy. He wasn't ready. Like, he did it too quickly. And he basically, the cool thing about MDMA is why I always tell people to start with it, because it's always your friend. It's so gentle. It's so soft. If it gets too intense, you can, like, sit up and take off your eye mask, and the impact goes from a 10 to a 2, right? And so he basically took his eye mask off, walked around the whole time. The emotions coming up were too much. They were overwhelming him. He was not ready or willing to feel them. Mm. And so he pushed them all down. And so like the impact the medicine had on him was pretty negligible. It just didn't do much, right? Because he wasn't willing to sit and process that. Whereas I was in a space when I first did it, I was willing to sit and process. Like I was willing to feel the feelings I didn't want to feel. You want to sum up what all this stuff does? It gives you the opportunity to feel feelings you don't want to feel. So that you can process them and then let them go.
Yeah, it's interesting. I talked to my friend Jason Ellis about his ayahuasca trip, and he said, so it forces you to look at the thing that is most painful in your life and the thing you're most in fear of. He's like, and you face it until it has less and less power over you. He said, and then what was revealed, he's like, I couldn't tell from the first day, but I could tell better in the second day of doing it with the shaman.
Right.
Was when the shaman would change the song, the memory would fade and something new would come in. Like it was triggered by his chant. Mm-hmm. So he, being a shaman, knew that like, okay, this part of the trip lasts 40 minutes,
yeah,
and I'll keep this beat and this song and this kind of blowing the tobacco smoke in his face. Yeah. And then as to ease him out, I then change the song. He said, and by the way, then it goes away and then it comes back just with a new face, but it's the same root of that pain and mm-hmm. you're forced to look at it again. And how often are you doing this?
It depends.
Yeah.
So my last session was the day after Thanksgiving. I haven't done anything since because it was a super intense. I used a new medicine that I hadn't used before, a pretty intense one, advanced one, and it fucking dropped me on my ass, dude. And so I'm 2 months out, and I probably – it'll be at least another month. Like if I do something really intense, then I try to take 90 days to integrate, right? Because, I mean, it's like – it's almost like imagine – I don't know. Imagine like – I'm trying to think of a good – imagine you get a big-ass thick book to read, right? You don't read it in a week or 2 weeks, right? Especially if it's really intense and there's a lot of knowledge in there. It can take you months to read.
Yeah.
And so like I think early on I went fast because I had done so much talk therapy. I knew – intellectually, I knew everything about my brain. I knew the map of my emotions. I just hadn't felt any of it. And so because I was focusing on MDMA – MDMA essentially helps you feel your emotions, right? And so I could do a lot of sessions fairly close together, a month, 2 months, because it was just feeling all the emotions that I knew about but I hadn't felt. Then it took me about a year to get through that phase. And then I started adding other medicines like psilocybin. And now I'm kind of at a point where I'm starting to find new stuff. Like I'm really starting to – I'm still in my healing journey, but I'm getting – to points that I never got to in talk therapy. I like to divide, and I could be wrong about this, but it seems to me like really what these medicines, they do two things. They help you heal and they expand your mind. And those can sometimes overlap, but I see them, at least in me, as very different things. And so, for example, MDMA is almost entirely a healing medicine. It's not much of a mind expansion medicine. Whereas like ayahuasca is mainly, in my experience, a mind expansion medicine. Although it has great healing powers, for most people, I don't recommend starting with ayahuasca because that is a deep end, man. And if you haven't done a lot of work, therapeutic work, or if you have done a lot of therapeutic work, then maybe it's a good starting point. But man, it will bring up dark shit and shove it in your face for a long time. You know?
Yeah, Ryan and I talked about this. Like, it's wonderful how plant medicine has really come into the forefront, and there are some really, you know, people that are big proponents of it. But you can't be cavalier.
Oh no, no,
you
no,
can't.
I when I first did this, my instinct was, oh my god, everyone's got to do it. And then I realized very quickly, I never tell anyone to do it ever.
Yeah,
all I do is talk about my experience. And the good and the bad. And then people, it's so funny, man. It's like, I'll see somebody and they'll be like, dude, you seem so different. Your energy's different. Like, you used to be an asshole. I couldn't stand being around you. Now I like kind of like you. And I've had so many people say that to me the last year. It's like both comical and also a little depressing. But and then they'll be like, what, you know, are you on like a new diet? And I'm like, carnivore diet? I'm like, no, dude. Like, and then I'm like, therapy. And then like, it's funny, like 90% of people use the T word and they're like, or trauma, they're like, they don't like, they'll listen politely, but they don't really want to hear more. But the ones that like really want to hear, then like I let them ask. And if they're like, oh man, do you know someone or whatever? Then it's like, okay, if I know them well and I think that they might be ready, then I'll refer them to, you know, whatever. I know a bunch of guides now. And so I'll refer them to someone I think, you know, might be able to help them. But I don't even connect them. I'm like, here's their email. Here's, you know, the how to contact them. You've got to initiate that. And then like you gotta set up the call, you gotta get on the call, you gotta decide you're gonna do it. You gotta put a few barriers in front of people, because if you go into this work and you're not ready, there's a price to pay. It can fuck you up. Like it's not,
yeah.
Don't do this casually. Like I'm telling you, even people who, like, I know people like, oh, I used to do LSD all the time in college, and then they do LSD therapy. They're like, what the fuck, man? That is a totally different experience. Setting an intention make a huge difference. It is essentially 90%+ of the impact.
Any interest in ketamine?
Yes. So I have used ketamine once because ketamine is the best thing for on-label use is suicidal ideation. So if like someone's going to kill themselves, ketamine is one of the best things there is for getting that out of their mind, at least for a few weeks. Also, chronic pain. Ketamine is amazing for those two things. And off-label use is ego destruction. Like, I have a very strong ego. It is a big part of what I have to deal with emotionally. And that's why I did that super high-dose psilocybin. I did a pretty high-dose LSD. Those were both intense, but I really don't think I had real ego death in those. And so I ended up doing a ketamine session. And yeah, dude, like, if that doesn't kill your ego, nothing will, man. Because it's dissociative. It's that the entire point of the medicine is to disconnect you from your emotions and yourself. And it is a true, dude, it was the craziest thing, man. It was the, okay, so I did ketamine, and not that much, man. I did a pretty low whatever. And as soon as, man, it hits, right? It goes, because it's IV, right? It goes fast. And you can do ketamine legally. It's in clinics. This is not, you don't have to find underground guys.
Yeah, now like the nose spray right. was approved.
Yeah, yeah, no, I went to like an actual clinic and IV, and it was all legal and above board. And dude, it hit me. And all of a sudden, everything starts, like all shapes and colors start get really fragmented. Like the borders in here, they go like that and they go black. And then it's like, I heard this voice in my head. I heard, they tricked you. This is your new reality. You're stuck here. You're gonna die.
Oh, fuck. No, Kevin, run.
No, and then not like it is in my head. And then, but then I said, no, I'm surrendering.
That is
I went
so,
in.
That'd be it for me. I would be the one that lost their fucking mind. I'd be like, that's it. It's a wrap.
Well, when you're in, dude. There's no coming out of ketamine. But you know, I didn't realize it till a few days later. That was my ego dying. Because it wasn't me thinking that. That was a voice I heard. It was the first time ever in my life I actually truly saw and experienced my ego as a distinct thing from me. And I was like, oh, my fucking. And I didn't even realize until a few days later. It was like, oh, man. And now it's like, now I get it. Now I understand all the shit I read about ego and all that stuff. None of it made any sense to me before. Because the ego's trick is to convince you that you are it. But you're not. It's just a part of you. I'll never forget that as long as I live, man. It was the craziest experience. Because I was like, fuck, man, I am going to die. A buddy of mine, this guy Dan Engel, you might have heard of. He's one of the big guys in this space. You should have him on your podcast.
Yeah.
He's amazing. He gave me some advice. If you get the invitation to die, take it. And I had no fucking idea what he was talking about, right? Because like I'm thinking, this happened on mushrooms and LSD both times. And I'm like, no, I'm cool. I want to stay alive. I get what he meant now. It's you're not going to die. That's your ego dying, not you dying, right? And so I didn't really take the invitation on ketamine. I just surrendered to it, which I guess is close enough. And so like I don't know if I had full ego death or not. I think I did. Whatever it was, man, it was the first time in my life. And then that was the one 2 months ago. And dude, my life has been straight up since then. Like everything has gotten better in every single way. It's amazing, dude.
But it's like ketamine from a recreational standpoint, and that's my only, I mean, obviously I know it in a clinical setting, but from what I've seen in movies and friends, my buddy Jude, who was on the show, used to use it very recreationally. And it like, you know, we know it to be in large doses, a horse tranquilizer. So like, does it knock you on your ass? Like,
oh yeah,
you,
no, dude, I was done. I was out.
Do you know you're you or are you like in another, you couldn't walk around?
Oh, fuck no. Dude, no. When I say black, I mean, you don't quite go into a case. It depends on the dosages, right? I've never done it recreationally. Only, you know, in a clinical setting with the doctor in there, nurse or whatever. Dude, it was, no, you are not mobile. This is
right.
This is a dissociative. Dude, it can also be used as an anesthetic in surgery.
Right.
That's how dissociative the properties are. So like I can give you ketamine to do surgery on you and you're not going to remember it or feel it, right? So like it is very much the only reason I did it was for the ego stuff. Like it's not I would on the list of medicines for people to do. Ketamine is basically at the bottom, man. It's down there with iboga, like the shit that actually can kill you, right? You only want to do these things for very specific reasons under very specific care. Like iboga is amazing. If you are like a 20-year, heroin addict, iboga will get you off. It'll get you a window where you have no more physical cravings. If you have serious like ego structure problems, ketamine will fucking break them. Right. So like, but otherwise, like my wife doesn't have those problems. She's probably not gonna be doing ketamine. Right. You know,
any temptation to microdose?
Yes. Microdosing psilocybin is amazing.
And do you do that?
Yes.
Every day?
No. You can't do it every day. The best dosing schedule that I do, I mean, I do it now. I didn't do it today. I did, what's today? Monday? I did Saturday. So I do one day on, at least 2 days off, and then one day back on. Sometimes I'll go 3 days off, sometimes even longer. But and a very small dose, like 50 to 75 milligrams.
Like
and
if you feel it, you did too much.
Yes. It should be, the whole point of microdosing is it's sub-perceptible, right? You just feel the impacts, not the medicine. So like, dude, if I showed you, I didn't bring microdose with me because that'd be weird. But if I showed you, you'd think it was like dust. Like it's a tiny amount, dude. Mm. It's like, it's hardly even like an actual thing. And so, but like, when I microdose psilocybin, I didn't like microdosing LSD. It just doesn't work for me. Psilocybin is amazing, dude. I just feel like the best version of myself. Like, you know, if you ever wake up and you're like, everything's just going great today. I just feel, it's like that, yeah. Except you constructed it. I have friends who are too afraid to do a serious dose of medicine, but they microdose and they're still seeing amazing benefits and changes. They only microdose.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's such a gray area for sober guys, and so I'm not quite sure. I think of it like red wine. Like, red wine's good for your heart. It's just not worth the advantages for me.
I get it.
The disadvantages, perhaps, are too great.
I would bring Dan Engel on your podcast.
Yeah.
Dan, I know a ton of people in this field. Dan is one of the ones who I trust the most. Like, when I have questions about medicine, I go to Dan with it, right? And he's a psychiatrist, right? So medical board doctor, but also trained in ayahuasca shamanism in the jungle. And this dude's done and seen everything, right? And he's very open about it. Ask him. I'm pretty sure that he's the one I know opening the clinic. I'm pretty sure at their clinic, they're going to be working with people who are recovering addicts. He used to have an Ibogaine clinic in Mexico. Mm. And so they worked with a ton of recovering people. He has a deep expertise in that field.
Any interest in TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation? Have you heard about it?
No.
It seems, it's interesting. There's this great comedian, Gary Goleman, who had that, he had a new special that Judd Apatow produced called The Great Depression. And what he talks about, he was like, I was so deeply depressed that my ketamine doctor turned me away.
Wow.
Yes. After months, he's like, mind you, my insurance doesn't cover this. So I was handing him $800 a pop 3 days a week.
I've never heard of that.
So much so that the doctor finally said, I can't ethically give this to you anymore because it's not helping you.
Yeah, no, clearly.
And he's like, right, but when I'm here, I feel great. Like for the day or for the, you know, 3/4 of a day I'm here, it's great.
Yeah.
And then the depression comes flooding back in. He's like, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, no, but you got to deal with the underlying issues.
Yeah, and he had done so much work. And so finally he got, and I'm not sure whether he did, I think he did a version of electroshock therapy. But what TMS is it's a very specific, it's targeting your brain of like a 9-volt battery level of current mm-hmm. They do specific protocols, either an anxiety or a depression protocol. And basically, and I had this physicist, brain doctor on named Safi Bakal on the pod. And he said, what we're finding more in depression and things that occur in the brain is that it's an actual injury. Like the brain is injured.
Trauma will do that. It'll create circuits you can't get out of, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, loops. That's why mushrooms work so well, dude.
Yeah.
No, because they reset the default mode network. But some people might be on that, which sounds like...
I mean, it's basically kind of like a brain reset. It's very specific targeting with the magnetic pulses. And it's, for someone like me who's afraid of taking in, you know, anything that's going to chemically alter me, I'm almost more, that is more appealing than...
Try it.
But but then again, I'm like, I guess I'm kind of happy, right, Kevin? Well, dude, I can't tell.
I will tell you, and I'm sure Dan will tell you the same thing. I will tell you that MDMA and psilocybin, neither of which, especially when used therapeutically, have shown to have really any addictive properties.
Mm.
You know? Like,
yeah.
I'm not saying you can't get hooked on ecstasy at clubs or something, like, but...
Yeah. I'm going to go to an ecstasy, clinic. I'm going to go to the only one, and they're going to hand me, blue pills with, Lamborghinis on them. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
I don't think they will.
It's probably a great time. You know, the only time I ever experienced ecstasy, I did it alone.
Uh-huh.
How sad is that? Yeah, you want to talk about depressing?
Yeah, that is.
I did it alone because I was just at my apartment and no one called me back that night. And I had this pill that I wondered what would do for a while. So I went to a strip club by myself. It was terrible.
Oh my God, on E.
I know. I thought it'd be great. What a mix.
Yeah, right?
Not good.
No. No, yeah, actually, I feel like that would be depressing.
Trust me, I got plenty of those stories. Okay, last question, the thing I ask everyone on the podcast, what are your one or two Tucker Max commandments, truths that you have discovered that you'd want to impress upon someone else?
Well, so I don't, I'm going to answer the question. I don't ever assume anything I do or say anyone else should do them. So I don't try to impress anything on anyone else, right? Mm-hmm. That's a lesson. That might be one, is that I do my own work only. I never tell anyone else what they should do. And I share my work. And if they can use my work as an example on their journey, that's great. But I never assume my journey is anyone else's because it's not. Everyone must walk their own path, right? And maybe parts of my journey can help others walk their path. But I never assume it does. But if there's one lesson or one thing that I live by, I mean, I know exactly what it is. I am always going to stand up and speak my truth. I'm always going to diligently work to uncover it, right? Because God knows, man, I've done so much work to uncover it. And it's so funny, man. I feel like I'm light years away from where I was 10 years ago in that hotel room in Tempe, right? And I feel like I've just started. I honestly feel like I'm at the beginning and I've done so much work, but it's cool because I'm like at a point where it's like, oh, now the work's starting to actually get fun. It's starting to get really rewarding. Like I feel like I've come through the worst parts, the hardest, maybe not the hardest parts, some of the worst parts, but it's really starting to trend really up in a kind of a great way. Because I'll tell anyone doing this work, it almost always gets worse before it gets better, you know? But anyway, so it's starting to get better, but that's the thing, man, is I will always uncover and speak my truth. Because otherwise, like, what am I doing, man? Like, what's the point of life if I'm not going to work to uncover and speak it or live it, you know? I don't understand the point.
Love it, man. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. That was it. That was Tucker. Not bad, right? Come on. Listen, guys, this is a weird time right now, and especially because, you know, I'm trying to interview podcast guests while also observing the quarantine and honoring that. So if I perhaps like maybe didn't do a traditional Curious episode in the following weeks and maybe did something more specific, maybe, I don't know. Feel free to email me, guys, at peckagent@gmail.com. That's peckagent@gmail.com. And email me your suggestions as long as they have nothing to fucking do with Drake and Josh. Like, with all due respect and love and care, you know, that's, I just feel like I might be better served right now. I don't know. Maybe I can do a cool like pandemic pod or just something to help get you guys through the next couple weeks in any way, give you a slight reprieve from the daily stress of looking at the stock market and Twitter and turn on the Curious podcast and get some laughs. Or maybe you're just like, Josh, just keep interviewing people. That's what you do. That's why we subscribed. I don't know, but feel free to email me, peckagent@gmail.com. If you have any suggestions for what you want to hear over the next couple weeks, love you guys. Hope you're safe and healthy and cozy and streaming things on Disney Plus, whom I work for, I hope, if I still have a job in a couple months. Okay. Love you guys. Bye.